Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for context and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 6th, 2015. Today we're joined by our co-host, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing today, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. Glad to have you here. So, D.R., we have spoken many times on this show about the upcoming Paris meeting of the IPCC in December, at which we expect and hope that there will be a treaty signed to address climate change. And part of the process of getting to that treaty is that each country will volunteer how much carbon they will promise to reduce as part of the commitments that they're going to make. And that's called, it goes by the acronym INDC for...
It's intended nationally determined contribution.
Thank you for saving me. Okay, so this is in the deadline to for all countries to give their intended nationally determined contribution estimates was March.
March 31st.
Say again?
March 31st,
which has just passed. Mm-hmm. And so, DR, what happened? First of all, tell me, what happened in Mexico?
Mexico, in late March, they issued their INDC report, basically saying that they were going to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions 22% below normal levels by 2030 and peak its emissions by 2026. It was the first developing country to formally submit its post-2020 emissions reductions goals according to Think Progress. And this is pretty significant for a number of reasons, obviously because of Mexico's closeness to the United States, because of Mexico's prominence as a country. I would also add that one of the reasons why it's significant, even though this doesn't seem to be discussed a lot, is the vocal climate activism of the former Mexican president Felipe Calderon, who has been very, very outspoken over the course of the past few years about the need for his country and other major countries to dramatically slash carbon emissions.
Yeah, I mean, I found it very interesting. There was, for a couple of reasons. One is that at least the article that I read from the Brookings Institute talked about the fact that this is a model, this being a collaboration between the United States and Mexico is kind of a model for lots of other countries to have bilateral or multilateral, you know, maybe they all get together in some part of Africa and make a, you know, have some sort of joint plan, lots of stuff going on, and that the commitments that Mexico made, which were pretty good as they stand, turns out they could make, they made conditional promises to do more cutting of carbon if certain conditions were met. And those conditions were, for example, could they get access to technology? And I think what they're meaning is, can they get some access to manufacture the, say, wind turbines in their own country? So the United States would have to be willing to expend some IP. That if the United States was willing to make some kind of adjustments at the border for carbon. So, for example, one of the issues is that one of the possibilities is that a country like the United States could put a tariff on incoming goods from another country that had not controlled their carbon pollution. And, of course, Mexico and the United States have a huge trade thing going on. So Mexico is saying, oh, look, we'll make a deal. If you promise not to put a tariff on our goods because of our carbon emissions, we will promise to reduce our carbon emissions by X, Y, and Z. You know, those kinds of things are important. They actually mean something in the context of negotiating a treaty. And from everything I've seen, Mexico gets kudos for being the first developed nation to actually make these submissions, right?
Yes, and it is definitely a bold step. And, you know, every time a country of this prominence, you know, takes these sorts of actions, it sort of undercuts the argument that, you know, major countries aren't willing to make the sacrifices necessary to reduce carbon pollution.
So there's Mexico. They got in under the wire on March 30th. They made the deadline. There was another big country that also made public their commitments, right, DR? What country
Yes.
was that, and what did those guys say?
Yes, it happened to be the United States, which is a great story to see. It's reported by Nash Claire Foran of National Journal that the United States announced just under the wire on March the 31st that would curb greenhouse gas emissions up to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025, and that this would be and that this would be done largely through executive action because of the usual partisan issues that we have previously discussed.
Right, that's what I saw. Yes, I saw the article by Coral Davenport in the New York Times, where basically saying, yeah, the Obama, we already know what Obama has done, right? He's trying to kill coal plants. I'll say that out loud. We got vehicle emissions are down. They're trying to put caps on methane. A lot of good stuff. The United States has promised a 28% reduction by 2030, which is another example of this bilateral deal making, because remember before Obama went to China, and China has commitments in the pipeline as well that they and we agreed to. But there's a couple of aspects here. One is that the Obama administration is trying to proceed solely through regulations, and in fact, I think you mentioned it, DR, they're making sure that whatever is written in Paris does not constitute a treaty. Because they know a treaty will never get passed. So they want an agreement that they can execute through executive order, right? And then the other thing that this article said is that Obama has to move quickly and get this, or expects to move quickly and get all this stuff approved over the next 2 years before he leaves office, right?
Yes, definitely.
And so there's a bunch of stuff going on there. And I guess, DR, let me ask you to describe the predictable reaction. I mean, what did the heads exploding sound like this time?
Well, there are two distinctly different reactions. One reaction came from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who, according to Think Progress, is now going around to other countries, basically saying you can't trust the United States and don't bother, putting together your own carbon reduction pact because there's no way the United States will honor its own carbon reduction pact. This was after the New York Times revealed that Mitch McConnell was writing letters to all 50 governors, basically encouraging them not to comply with the EPA's Clean Power Plan as a way to basically sabotage Obama. Efforts ahead of Paris. But there was also an interesting reaction that the New York Times, that the Washington Post editorial page and a writer named Stephen Stromberg of the Washington Post picked up on, which was the reaction of Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who criticized Obama's proposal on the ground not that it's unnecessary to do this, not on the grounds that it's a hoax, but on the ground that it doesn't do enough for nuclear power. And the New York Times and the Washington Post editorial page and Stephen Stromberg basically made the argument that one can dispute, the wisdom of relying on nuclear power as an alternative, but it's nice to see at least some members of the Senate, or at least one member, proposing an alternative rather than full-on denial and full-on obstruction. So it's a very, very interesting to see the two responses, one basically saying, hell no, we won't cut CO2, and another response saying, well, there's an alternative path. It will be interesting to see which one really wins out politically and in terms of this whole debate.
Right, and I find the idea that the leader of the U.S. Senate would be going to other countries, executing his own foreign policy, and trying to undercut his own president in the international arena, I think it's beyond reprehensible. I just that's an opinion of Ted's opinion about what people should be doing, what the senators should be doing in terms of relating to foreign leaders, and not undercutting their own president.
And there is something we should warn people about when we talk about efforts to sabotage the Paris talks. You may remember in 2009 in Copenhagen, Senator James Inhofe and a couple of other senators, I think one was Roger Wicker of Mississippi, went over to Copenhagen to basically launch what they called a quote-unquote truth squad to basically demonize any effort by the United States to cut a deal. I fully expect we will see more denialists head over to Paris in an attempt to basically sabotage and throw as many monkey wrenches as possible into these climate talks. It's going to become, I'm afraid these things are going to turn into a circus, and this is the last thing we need.
Well, I think it's yeah. I mean, we shouldn't pat ourselves on the back, but believe me, independent media like podcasts like this will be trying to point out those behaviors, even if they don't get into the international, I mean, into the national news, right? So tell me,
Definitely.
So then there was another, as part of the fallout of all this stuff, the ongoing opposition to attempts to constrain carbon, there were a couple of votes on carbon, well, I'll call it carbon tax, the carbon fee, right, that happened in the U.S. Senate.
Yes,
So what happened there?
there was a vote that occurred, a number of votes in what's known as the Votorama, I believe it's called, where it's basically one of these sort of, more a sense of the Senate votes, or basically, op-eds by the U.S. Senate. And one was a vote on an amendment sponsored by Missouri Senator Roy Blunt, basically, rejecting the whole logic of implementing a carbon tax. It passed 52 to 48. It passed, unfortunately, on a bipartisan basis, and it was strongly denounced by the hometown. By the hometown newspaper, Senator Blunt, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which pointed out that, when Roy Blunt demonizes and demagogues a carbon tax, he's demagoguing a climate solution that's embraced by other members of his party and other members of his general political philosophy, who say this is a great market-based measure to tackle. And there was also another amendment in this Votorama sponsored by Senator Bernie Sanders of Congress, basically saying that the Congress has a
And just so
duty
everyone
to.
knows, Bernie Sanders is the white-haired guy from Vermont. He's a socialist independent, but he caucuses with the Democrats, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
That's correct. And that amendment failed to pass. It was 50-49, but the 49 votes, there was a bipartisan composition to the 49 votes in favor of that Sanders amendment. So, and I want to correct what I said earlier, the Blunt amendment was passed 58-42, not 52-48. Obviously failing to make the 60 votes, but it's interesting to see in these two votes. You had this sort of negative vote of for the in favor of the Blunt Amendment, but a positive development in terms of having 49 senators say we need to take action on this issue.
Right. Interesting, interesting. So I guess the other thing that I saw was that in New Jersey, there was an article that talked about Chris Christie's recent behavior in New Jersey, where I guess he came in as something of a clean energy advocate, but now that he has pretensions to the presidency, all of a sudden he has his administration has stopped a big wind turbine project that was going in off the shores of New Jersey. I don't know if you,
Yes.
did you see that?
Yes, I did see there was a great piece in the Washington Post on March the 30th, basically talking about how once Governor Christie began to sort of get Potomac fever, he started ignoring the planetary fever and basically started throwing as many monkey wrenches as possible into the development of clean energy in the state. And I've mentioned this before, and it bears mentioning again. In May of 2011, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie pulled his state out of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the multi-state effort that Massachusetts is a part of to cut carbon pollution. And in his speech, he actually started off the speech comprehensively describing the issue and comprehensively explained that this was human caused and that action needed to be taken before trying to suggest that the RGGI was some sort of a boondoggle. So this guy fully understands what the issue is, but for numerous reasons, one of which was exposed by the investigative journalist Brad Friedman, the fact that he's friends with Charles and David Koch, all of a sudden he developed this sort of sour position on clean energy and the sour position on RGGI. And it's one of the great tragedies because, as Joe Rome pointed out, back in 1989, Tom Keene, who's the member of the same party that Chris Christie is a member of, who is the governor of New Jersey, put together a comprehensive plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to prepare and to adapt for the risks that New Jersey would face, and to see, in the course of 25 years, this New Jersey going from Tom Keene, who was forward thinking, to Chris Christie, who's doing something
Not.
other than thinking, I would suggest, is really, really sad.
Oh man, so the time keeps marching on. The other story that we wanted to talk about is one that's breaking recently, within the last 12 hours or so, and that has to do with water out in California.
Yes, it's a major, major story, and I think it's going to be remembered as one of the biggest stories of the year. A mandatory water reductions being imposed by California Governor Jerry Brown on the Golden State, which has been just devastated by drought over the course of the past 4 years. The New York Times reporting that in executive order, Governor Brown has directed the State Water Resources Control Board to impose a 25% reduction on the state's 400 local water supply agencies, and the agencies will be responsible for coming up restrictions to cut back on water use and for monitoring compliance. Sadly,
In other words, that means that they'll come arrest you if you're watering your lawn or something, right?
there'll be restrictions on watering gardens and lawns and washing cars and what have you. However, there has been evidence has emerged that this these restrictions don't go as far as they need to go, and they seem to basically leave the agriculture industry in California alone, the agriculture industry, which consumes an enormous amount of water, and for various legal reasons and presumably political reasons, they are not held to high account the way they should be for consuming what little water California has. California basically has, they have virtually no snowpack anymore, and
Well,
the lack of water is just severe. I mean, the whole state's dry, basically.
yes.
So.
But I guess, I mean, it's an interesting thing because we talk about a water ban in California. Oh, too bad for those guys. They can't wash their cars outside anymore. But there's a reality here that even if the agricultural interests can use water, eventually that water is going to dry up too. And the Central Valley of California is essentially a breadbasket for the nation, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of food produced in California that is eaten across the country for better or worse. And I mean, this kind of climatic disruption, I think it's fair to say, that this certainly whatever's going on is consistent with climate change. This has long-term impacts for what people eat in Boston. Right,
Exactly,
because
exactly.
your foxy lettuce isn't going to be around anymore.
Exactly, and the lettuce and fruits and vegetables that do appear will be through the roof in terms of price, and it goes to two points. Number one, the argument that taking action on climate change will be too expensive. No, climate change itself will be too expensive. And number two, the point that needs to be made that in the initial reporting of this story, especially on broadcast networks, the only network that appeared to connect the dots specifically between this and climate change was the PBS NewsHour in their coverage on April the 1st. And the only connection was made by Governor Jerry Brown himself, not by any of the reporters, which goes to show you how much more needs to be done in terms of comprehensive coverage of this issue. Because, I mean, there's a report. On March the 31st, I believe, on mediaite.com, discussing why was it that the broadcast media wasn't covering this drought in California. They suggested that, among other things, it was East Coast bias and a reluctance to connect the climate dots. And it's like, when you have something like this staring you right in the face, this is not normal. This is not natural. You've got to cover it, and you've got to connect the dots because, just for the sake of your own credibility, it doesn't happen for no reason. I mean, come on, cover the story and
An act of
explain why
God, huh?
exactly it is an act of us.
Oh, goodness. Well, we got to stop there, DR. Let me remind our listeners that they can find links to most of the stuff we've talked about on our website. It's massclimateaction.wordpress.com. You can leave us a comment there, or you can send us an email to comment@massclimateaction. You can find us on Facebook/massclimateaction. You can like us, share our show. Please take a look. A lot of the links that we talk about are there as well. You can listen to the show directly on Stitcher. You can listen to us on iTunes. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.